news, reviews, commentary, not just another podcast.
Out of the Ordinary, the Big Ball Broadcast.
Now here comes your host, Kyle Abaron of the World Team.
Welcome to the Big Ball Broadcast. This is episode 132 with all the geeky news you can use. Part of the geekmedia.com, firmly planted on the interwebs at thebigballbroadcast.com. Streaming live each and every Thursday night, well, most anyway, on Stickam at 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific at www.stickam.com/bigballbroadcast. From the West Coast, this is Kyle Abaron, an anime and video game voice actor.
And your co-host of the East Coast, LOL Steve, I am a musician with Perimeter of the Void.
Music you hear in the background right now as we introduce our show is brought to you by DJ Unicron. Check out his page at statesidehardcore.com. And running behind the scenes, of course, is our illustrious engineer, Mark Swint, pushing buttons, making sure that we're live, making sure that we're edited and sound all pretty and professional in Hollywood. And what else are we forgetting to pimp here, dude?
Well, we can always come back to pimping, but how about some teasing? Tease us with some okay. Of those sexy, sexy headlines.
Ooh, baby. All right. I'm going to tweak your audio nipples with Deadpool movie scoop. Facebook exposing users after changes to their privacy policy. Microsoft, difference between cheat, exploit, none. Banned. Slayer getting their game on. Record labels facing $6 billion in damages for pirating artists. Judge finalizes a $675,000 RIAA piracy verdict and won't gag the defendant. Plus, a top 10 list that has two additional on there just because it's fun. The top 12 nerdiest cult shows that need to be on DVD. This, plus your emails and interactions from our illustrious chat room. Hello, chat room on Stickam. Now we can pimp stuff, right?
Right. Perimeter of the Void, we have four songs available for download as a bundle for $350. And if you fan us on Facebook, you can get a 50% off coupon code for use over at ebrecords.com. And you can take those four songs for, I think it's $1.75. I think it's a pretty kick-ass deal. It's like a dust available for free. I want to throw props out to a dude who bought our physical CD from the UK. I don't want to drop names in case he's, you know, shy or whatever, but thanks so much for that. And yeah, I think that's about it for now. Perimeter of the Void, ebrecords.com, perimeterofthevoid.com.
Perimeter of the Void, Perimeter of the Void. And you get to spend, what, like $37.50 to mail it overseas?
It wasn't too bad. I lost 32 cents in this endeavor. The CD was $5. The flat rate shipping for the U.S. was $1.50. So that's $6.50 coming in, and it was like $6.82 to mail. So I'll eat it because it went to the U.K. So maybe it'll become a big underground success.
That's right, and then he'll stick it online and then share it, and then all of the UK
at this point, you know, screw it, I don't care. You know, we're going to talk about some music piracy in the RIA lawsuits later on, but everybody has my permission. Go to ebrecords.com, download the Dust album, and then put it like on every torrent and download site you're aware of. You have my permission.
Yay! Permission from the Perimeter. Something I can promote right now is a 2-for-1 special on my private voice acting consultations. This is something that I do over Skype, so it's available no matter where you live in the world. Hell, even on Mars. That'd be pretty cool. Talk to aliens. But anyway, what I do in that is basically critique your voice acting. This is aimed at beginner-level amateur voice actors who are interested in seeing what they got, how well their chops are, and get critiqued by someone in the industry, a.k.a. me. What I'm doing right now, my usual price is $75 for an hour. And what I'm doing is buy one, get one free. It's good through the entire rest of this year. So you got a couple weeks left. Give a gift. Give the gift of voice acting consultation. If you suck, I'll tell you suck, but I'll be really nice about it. But if you're good, I'll also tell you you're nice about it. Does that make any sense? No, not really. Anyway, the consultation is not a replacement for acting workshops or experience or anything like that. But again, you need a professional ear, a critique, someone to do script workouts with and can give you some guidance. What's an audition like? What is a recording session like? You can see a super light free version of this at cons that I go to. And you can check the latest appearance update for all the cons I have so far listed for 2010 listed at kyleabaron.com. So buy one, get one free, $75. You pay by PayPal. And then we set up a time, get on Skype. You don't need a webcam. This is not visual. Just need to be able to hear you. You don't even need a demo. But if you have one, we can use that time to critique it, break it down, tell you what your strengths are, what you need to work on. And yeah, that's basically it. What else do we need to talk about here, Steve?
I don't know. I think I'm fresh out to talk about. Show's over. See ya.
Nice. That's it, everybody. Have a good night. No, actually, let's move to our inbox because it's not overflowing, but we got a couple of emails here. So thank you guys in advance for that. If you keep on saying to yourself, "Oh, I meant to email them, but I forgot." What's the address, Kyle? It's mail@thebigballbroadcast.com. It's as simple as that. Mail@thebigballbroadcast.com. And our first email comes from Chris, who says, "I think that people should stop spending all their time playing WoW and go do normal stuff. Though I play video games, I don't play all the time. I'm too busy socializing. Have they ever talked to anyone besides of the opposite sex, besides their mother? Have they ever went to a party? Have they got those achievements? People should go out and do stuff besides being lazy." Well, very well said there, Chris. But, you know, to each their own. People are going to do what they're going to do. Everyone has their own crack. Everyone has their own addiction. Some people smoke. Some people do drugs. Some people drink. Other people play console games. Other people play PC games. And the level of addiction, we've talked about it here on the show a lot. Internet addiction is a real addiction. It's kind of a hybrid, though, because it's an addiction, and yet it's like the evolution of us as a society, you know. It's kind of weird, but yeah, all the signs of addiction are there, and people lose. I don't personally know any friends of mine that disappear for hours on end and lose their jobs and forget to bathe and eat and all that stuff, but we know those stories are very real and they circulate, and it's obviously an issue.
I did that before there was an internet, and it was called playing in a band, where I wouldn't come home and I wouldn't sleep and I wouldn't shower or change my clothes for days. But, you know, like you said, Kyle, to each his own. Whatever you're passionate about and you throw your time into, everybody's got, you know, their fix. So it's kind of unfair to call a specific group out, especially because I don't think the majority of the people that play WoW, you know, do that. It's a misconception that's out there in the interwebs and pop culture. But if it was all that dangerous, you know, you'd probably hear a lot more about it. So it's all good.
They're not any more fodder for satire and parody other than any other groups like Harry Potter fans, Lord of the Rings fans, Star Wars geeks. I mean, everyone's geeky about something, right?
Anime fans. Was at a con recently with Kyle and Mark, and cosplay still kind of scares me just a little. Don't get me wrong. I want to really, you know, tip my hat to a lot of the female cosplayers who are in good shape and decided to show up scantily clad in below zero weather, but that's besides the point. Yeah. No, I mean, sometimes it's hypocritical, especially when it comes from an anime fan, because it's like, oh, please, let's not draw the comparison to anime fans and WoW fans. This could take all night. But I couldn't get into it because I think I look at it peripherally and say, yeah, that could be like a total time suck, and I have better things, not better things, but I have other things, other commitments in my life. I could never even consider delving into something like that with, you know, the time requirement to do certain quests and side missions and level up your character. I can see the appeal for the addiction there, and that's, you know, I gotta be preemptive and go, no WoW for me. Kyle, you must consider yourself so fortunate because you're so ADD. It wouldn't even be the worth of signing up on the servers for you to play WoW.
Yeah, I doubt my laptop or my desktop even has, it doesn't have a video card. I can't even play Steam games, for crying out loud. So, and I'm a console gamer. That just comes from starting with an Atari 2600 all the way up to now. Xbox is my console of choice for online gaming. PS3 is a great system. I love it. I'm not really brand specific. I'm really more about the games. So I'll pop on a PS3. I'll play God of War. Not lately. You guys are rolling your eyes and snickering. I understand. I got to get past that Hydra. But lately, my time suck, Modern Warfare 2. I will hop online with some friends late night, kill 2-3 hours, and that is my sleeping pill. But I know where to draw the line. You know, it's like, I got to get up. I got to go to bed. I got stuff to do. And I go, and I understand that a lot of people, they get sucked into this atmosphere, this second life, and yeah, they let little things go by the wayside, maybe personal hygiene and all that. And if that needs an intervention from friends or family, then so be it.
because, you know, sometimes what happens is you go without little things like breathing, and they find you dead at your computer. I understand, you know, and that's why it's really got out there. You know, people have died because they're just so addicted to these games and they can't break away from the computer. There was this really sad case on Dig just this past week, talking about a mom who's being brought up on pretty severe charges because of the degree of child abuse due to neglect to her child, because she was just at her computer all the time and she just was not taking care of her kid as a result. So, yeah, it's pretty dangerous, but you know what? If we didn't have the internet, it'd be something else. It's kind of like the way the news likes to sensationalize things that go on, especially with violence in video games. If it isn't video games, it's going to be something else. So, you know, for all you know, she'd be a heroin addict or something. So, again, I think it's kind of unfair just to call out people, WoW players in particular, because if you have that type of compulsive behavior, you're going to find your own vice for it.
That's right. I think one of the biggest addictions out there is something that's existed long before the internet. It's just, you know, sports fandom. You know, people dressing up in body paint in sub-zero weather and doing that whole thing and just getting so into it, having these massive parties, getting totally shit-faced and drunk and throwing popcorn at the screen and all that. I mean, that's, it's the same level of fervor. It's just, you know, fill in the blank.
Concurred.
All right. Well, moving on to another email from Brandon, who actually submitted a link from radoff.com. It's a blog called Six Wonderful Things About Games. He says, I found this interesting and figured that you guys would too. So, Steve, check this out and see if you agree that these are, in fact, six wonderful things about video games. First of all, games make you smarter. They can excite people for high-paying careers. They inspire tangential learning, which means learning something new that you may have otherwise not known about. They enhance creativity. They foster advanced social skills, and they could help end war.
It just sounds so much of a stretch to me. It's funny. Don't get me wrong. I mean, yeah, there actually are some valid merits to playing video games. I know it's been proven that it helps with your reaction time. The government likes it in particular because a lot of missile guidance and predator drone guidance is all done essentially with a PS2 controller. So if they have somebody who's very proficient with, you know, playing on the controller, very dexterous, you can get a great gig in the military doing that, playing a video game in real life, which is kind of every gamer's dream. Not that I advocate you join the military just to do that, but this is a footnote there. So there are certainly some benefits. I think the pros outweigh the cons. We're not in that panic stage right now. We hit the panic stage in the 50s with comic books, with how comic books had a direct tie to juvenile delinquency, particularly in teen males in America. And all this fervor was because of a book that was written, Seduction of the Innocent, calling out comic books as the cause of juvenile delinquency. And the lashback was ridiculous. People were literally burning comic books in the streets. So we're not seeing that with video games. So I think some of the positive merits of video games are getting out there. People understand that. And, you know, a lot of it comes back to parental guidance. Unless you're an adult doing stupid shit and just, you know, playing games 24/7, then you just, you know, you win a Darwin Award for that. But I think there's enough merit out there. You're not going to hear anybody about, you know, creating parental groups and pulling the plug anytime soon. So whatever, just roll with it. It's all good.
Right, right. This article says... it says, is there any coincidence that nerds who are into games have an aptitude for math and science? I don't know. That's kind of a generalized statement, because I love games, but I do not have an aptitude for math or science. And that games stand to make people interested in those subjects. I don't think I agree with that. Not so much.
It's one of those weird things where I don't think it's really been studied on that type of level. I think the only studies that we've seen that have come out of major universities or major hospital study groups has been the correlation between violence in video games and violence with real life, or the propensity to be violent in real life. And those findings have been kind of mixed. I don't know. There's really no standard way to test somebody, because just the term game is so incredibly vague. Are you a casual gamer? Are you a hardcore gamer? Are you MMO, RPG, or are you FPS? There's so many factors. A study like that would probably cost, you know, upwards of $10 million to conduct. But, you know, if a university or hospital group want to send me $10 million, I will undertake that study for you. I will take on that burden.
Yeah.
But I think it'd be interesting to see how that would pan out if you could actually, you know, put some scientific fact behind some of these statements.
Yeah. Well, this does say some research has been done that your typical teenage gamer is no more or less antisocial than any other group. And that they, in fact, become more comfortable with face-to-face communication after being so immersed in that online world. That's something that kind of struck me as weird.
I would call it one out and say I think some people would probably be more comfortable having that level of anonymity on the internet than they would be having a face-to-face conversation.
Yeah, I mean, think about the whole 4chan thing. You think that that whole legion of people that go out harassing websites and doing all this weird stuff and hacking websites and just being the center of controversy, if there were no internet, there'd be no 4chan. So what sort of force would you have besides that? All these kids that would not get behind the anonymity and being a loud online voice, but in reality, being just like the end of Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back when they go to the actual houses of these smack talkers and they're like little 12-year-old kids that and they just punch them right there. Like, are you Ain't It Magnolia fan 37X? Yeah.
You know. Greatest part of the movie. But I am pretty sure we're going to get to that point anyway, because it is a very interesting topic. I think just the internet addiction issue is a very good topic that demands some research too, because as you stated earlier, Kyle, it's part of who we are now. There is no turning back. You know, we've opened Pandora's box. It's not going back in.
Yep. We are not. It says also that helping to end war, that was a curious one. It brings up the fact of the Olympics, how they were the original conception of the Olympics was to prevent war, getting all these different cultures coming together for a common goal, learning a bit about each other. Do you think there's anything to that? Because if anything, games like modern warfare and everything teach people who go off and join the military, they think that war is suddenly a video game. So you got video games trying to imitate life, and then life becomes the video game.
I was just thinking that, you know, the Olympics started off with, you know, indeed these delusions of grandeur, but Hitler kind of put a stop to that when they hosted the Olympics, and it kind of took the whole essence of fair play out the window long before video games came along. And it's also funny, too, how you talk about, you know, wartime FPSs, a lot of them take place in World War II, and the enemy's Nazi Germany. So what have I learned from history and through video games is that, no, I can't forgive Germany for the atrocities that happened 70 years ago. How dare they? But no, seriously.
Nice.
I just totally forgot what we were talking about.
Yes, and now we're officially derailed. If you can remember what Steve was talking about, type it in the chat room and we'll bring that up. Back up. What we're going to do right now is take a little break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about all sorts of stuff. We're talking about Slayer playing on Xbox Live. We're going to talk about pirating music and all this stuff. Nerdy cult TV shows that still aren't on DVD. Facebook changing their whole privacy policy. We're talking about Deadpool, the movie. What's the latest rumors on that? And factoids. Is it all coming up next right here on the Big Ball Broadcast?
Hey anime fans, are you ready for the ultimate anime podcast? Then get ready for the Rising Sun podcast. The anime mavericks are ready to give you all the anime news, reviews, and interviews you crave. And speaking of interviews, our first episode features the Big Ball Broadcast's own, Kyle Hebert. So head over to animemavericks.co.cc and check out The Wastelander, The Lady Kru, The Karate Bum, The Hybrid Rain, and me, The Shades, as we bring you the Rising Sun Podcast. We'll see you there.
She's calm.
There are a couple of other things I'll just tell you when I remember.
He's crazy.
If you could not see the similarities in the personalities within like the first couple of episodes, you need brain surgery. I mean, seriously.
Can two people get together and record a podcast without driving each other crazy?
Slap.
Oh, you didn't have to hit me so hard.
It wasn't that hard.
Find out on Anime Jam Sessions with your hosts, DJ Ranma S and Kuro Usagi. Log on to djranmas.net/animejam or look up Anime Jam Sessions on iTunes.
Why, hello there. Do you sit in front of a microphone recording whatever may be on your mind, then post it on the vast series of tubes called the internet? Then you, my friend, have a podcast. And like any podcast, you need to get it out there, really whore it up. But does your promo sound like this?
I implore you to listen to the Big Bald Broadcast.
This sucks.
Why misadvertise the quality of your podcast when we at Pro Podcast Promo have just what you need? P3 has a metric ton of voices and editing talent just waiting to work for you. Talent like these fine gentlemen right here.
Please, if you don't hire us, he beats us.
At least he feeds you. Please, you have to help us.
Now, boys, remember, if you don't behave, you don't get Kwanzaa. Then why don't you shimmy on down and send us an email at thetechnical@thebigbaldbroadcast.com. You heard it here. Pro Podcast Promo and all of its talent is waiting to hear from you.
Hi, I'm Tara Platt.
And I'm Yuri Lowenthal.
And you're listening
to
the Big Bald Broadcast. What?
The BB. The BBB.
You're the big BB.
No, that's the...
You're a BB gun.
No,
what are we talking
about? Big Bald Broadcast.
You can't even say that. Say that three times fast. Try it.
Big Bald Broadcast. Big Bald Broadcast. Big Bald Broadcast. Big Bald Broadcast.
Okay, that's why he gets the big bucks.
I could only do that because I was staring at Kyle's face on the monitor as I was doing it. Enjoy the show.
Yay for joining the show. Welcome back to the Big Bald Broadcast, currently streaming live on StickCam. And if you're not hearing it live, you're hearing it courtesy of thebigbaldbroadcast.com. Either way, we've infiltrated your brain, and we're damn proud of it. Oh, let's start talking about geeky stuff, shall we? Let's start with Deadpool. Why? Because I'm a big Deadpool nut. And AintItCool.com, one of my favorite movie sites, says this is a very, very strong rumor and not confirmed, but I'm kind of salivating at this all the same. Fox is considering hiring the writers of Zombieland to pen the Deadpool screenplay, Rhett Reese and Paul Wernick. This makes me very, very happy. Meanwhile, Ryan Reynolds recently discussed the role on MTV and said he has not tried on any Deadpool outfits lately. And he's told Fox that if there's going to be a Deadpool trailer, he has to be like the narrator. He has to be the one talking to the audience and saying, "In a world gone mad, one man must stand alone." He says, you want to find the best version of what's in the comic books. But like a lot of characters, Deadpool has one of the more inconsistent narratives. It's tough because the series has been dropped and reopened so many times. You really have to pick and choose so many of the best elements and cobble those together and create the movie of your dreams. And oddly enough, I think the suit is the easiest task. It's such a cool looking suit. It's just deciding on the material and stuff. But that comes into play once you get a script. So the big concern that even I have is that he is not only tapped to play Deadpool, he's also tapped to play Green Lantern. So are we going to see like a wisecracking Green Lantern? He brings up the point that, quote, these are roles that just happen to fall under the umbrella of comic book universe. There's a vast difference between the characters, and I think people forget that I'm an actor. I think there was some concern that I would make Green Lantern some kind of wisecracking Wade Wilson type. That's not the case at all. If that's what they wanted, why would I have screen tested for the movie? So I still have no interest for Green Lantern, but I am excited about a reboot that has sort of been hinted at for Deadpool, the movie, because the treatment of his character in Wolverine X-Men Origins leaves a lot to be desired. Other than it did seal the deal for audiences that's like, wow, he's a good Deadpool. That makes me happy. Yay.
Well, it's hard to say if he's a good Deadpool because he hasn't been Deadpool yet. My biggest concern with the franchise is how are they going to reckon the events of X-Men Origins Wolverine? I mean, that was pretty traumatic for the character. I don't know how they're going to back themselves out of that one.
This is true. But, you know, just like in comic books, they're always reinventing. I don't like what the hell is going on in Batman right now, but there's people just buying it hook, line, and sinker, no matter across three or four brand new series. It's like, oh, no, Bruce Wayne's dead. It's like, no, he's not.
And he's going to be a pirate.
Yeah, he's a pirate, don't you know?
He's a pirate. Captain Jack Sparrow, Bruce Wayne, whatever you want to call him. A pirate.
Yeah.
There's actually production sketches of it up on DC's blog. This is real, kids. This isn't our imagination.
So over at Marvel, since they're owned by Disney, people are worried about that. I just think they're smoking better weed. I don't know.
somebody's doing something, you know. They have this grand vision of bringing Batman back. Batman isn't dead, all right? If this is a huge Batman spoiler for you, jam your fingers in your ears, right through your earbuds. It's all good. But Batman's not dead. He somehow got transported back in time. And they're going to start with Caveman Batman, which, you know, I can't make fun of. He looks pretty badass, and the premise is pretty tight, so I hope everybody enjoys that. He's going to move up through history, and he's going to be Pirate Batman, and eventually he's going to make it back into the modern age and, you know, resume being Batman all over again. But some of the conceptual stuff, it's actually pretty cool. It's actually pretty refreshing in the current state of comics, and you could probably speak a lot more to that, Kyle.
Well, I don't know. I mean, does this tie over to the Blackest Night storyline, or is that separate?
I haven't the foggiest. I really don't follow the comic thing anymore. And anyways, I was a Marvel fan and not a DC. To me, it was a very clear dividing line, you know. Elvis or Beatles and Sony or Microsoft. So I was Marvel all the way.
Ah, okay. All right. Well, I got to admit, the only Marvel title, the only comic I get consistently is Deadpool. And the only Batman stuff I'll get is the only other comic I'll get, which is the one that Kevin Smith is currently writing, a miniseries. Other than that, I kind of look at stuff. It doesn't suck me in as much as it used to, but I'm still there every week, a new comic day, just in case. Just to feel young, I guess, because I'm an old fart. But alas. Maybe we should move on before I start crying here. Want to talk about Microsoft?
Sure. What exactly about Microsoft? All right. This is something that I know it seems to be beating like a dead horse, but there's even more shenanigans going on over on Microsoft's end. Apparently Microsoft says, what's the difference between a cheat and an exploit? None. You're banned. Microsoft has begun issuing temporary bans to players taking advantage of an exploit in Modern Warfare 2, while Infinity Ward works on a patch to fix the issue. While the service may be kept slightly cleaner for the efforts, the amount of control Microsoft holds over owners of their consoles and the arbitrary way they are wielding it is troubling. Now, Stephen Toolsole, the Director of Policy and Enforcement of Xbox Live, says when gamers need to be banned, it's his job to find them and cut them off Xbox Live access to their machines. The latest group to get his attention, gamers using the exploit on Call of Duty Modern Warfare 2 to increase their kill counts. First it was piracy leading to mass bannings, and now Microsoft is tasked with keeping Modern Warfare 2 servers clean while Infinity Ward works on a patch. The issue in question is called the Javelin exploit, which allows players to detonate a grenade instantly upon death. And while Infinity Ward works on getting the Modern Warfare 2 glitch fixed, people caught using it will receive suspensions from live play. Will get suspensions from live. Play fair, everyone, Tulsa said via Twitter. He also noted that the policy isn't anything new and that it's in place for more games in this Modern Warfare 2. If you get caught taking advantage of the exploit, you'll be banned for 24 hours. If you're a particularly bad case, the banning could last up to 2 weeks. And the ban isn't just for Modern Warfare 2, it's for the entirety of Xbox Live. If you're banned, no new content for you. No playing online in anything. And Major Nelson posted the details on his blog stating, quote, keep in mind, this isn't just a ban on a particular game. This ban is on the Xbox Live service as a whole, so you won't get to go online and do anything during your ban. Initially, you may be banned up for a day, a week, or depending on your severity, permanently. Kiss that $50 goodbye, he wrote. Now, the troubling aspect about the case of Modern Warfare 2 is that no one is changing the code for the game and no rules are being broken. They're simply taking advantage of the behavior of two particular weapons when used in a certain way. From Microsoft's side of things, that's cutting the hair too fine. And if you find a glitch and use it in the game, that's cheating, which apparently is in violation of the terms of service. Kyle?
While I play that game, this is the first I've heard of it. I don't think I'm well versed enough in the game to even take advantage of an exploit like that, and it doesn't even interest me anyway. It's like, okay, I'm going to increase my number of kills. What? So what? Really? I mean, is that an achievement thing? Probably not. I mean, I like achievements. Who doesn't like achievements? But in the end, it doesn't really matter. It's just kind of a bragging right sort of thing. So I'm not going to find myself taking advantage of that. I don't really see the point.
I think the bigger question that this article is calling into question is what the players are doing isn't necessarily cheating. Nobody's altering the code to the game. Nobody's running a hack or anything. It's mechanics that are built into the game by the developer, and somebody has found a way to incorporate these two weapons where upon your death, a grenade explodes and anybody in the vicinity dies as well. So that's what makes things a little scary in the Microsoft bans, is that nobody is really violating the terms of service except for the very vague area that they have about if you find an exploit and use it to your advantage, that's a violation of the terms of service. There's no real definition for that. What's an exploit? What's a hack? What's modding your console? You know, if you're having heat sink issues and you try to be preemptive and you buy a new heat sink or whatever and it breaks your console, Microsoft's like, oh, well, that's on you. That you can kind of understand. But when you're doing normal gameplay, that all code built by the developer, and Microsoft says, oh, you're cheating, banned. Is that fair?
That's iffy. Now, we'll see how fast Infinity Ward can respond with a patch. I mean, sometimes I look at and I play these online matches, and the level of skill, quote unquote, is like shocking. It's like, man, everyone just snipes, and I get really frustrated really fast. I'm not a sniper. I'm a casual gamer. I don't eat, sleep, and breathe this stuff all the time. I enjoy it. I join it enough to play practically every night, couple hours at least, and I love it. But that part is oof, not into that.
I don't know. I guess I put a lot more thought into this.
Yeah, you always do. I'm not the one who thinks. I'm not the one who talks. I'm the safe guy.
Well, it's kind of disturbing. I guess the good news is that Sony already said they're not going to do that to people on their servers. They're saying it's pretty much Infinity Ward's issue, and they have to deal with the patch. But in the meantime, they're not going to invest the manpower into banning people for something that they consider arbitrary and Microsoft considers the end of the world. Now, as far as PC gamers are concerned, if you use the exploit in the PC game, yes, you're still going to get banned. And the chance of a permaban is pretty high if you're doing it on the PC level. So I think it's kind of shameful for Microsoft and Infinity Ward. There's no real harm being done. Nobody's exchanging anything for real-life currency or anything. This is all virtual. It seems really childish. It's kind of straight-up bullshit. But because Microsoft's legalese is so vague, they can say whatever they want in post and make it sound like, you know, well, we're being victimized. I just don't think it's fair. I like Sony's approach, saying, fuck it, they're really not doing anything wrong, and it's not our problem. If anyone's working on a patch, well, here's their incentive to go ahead and get it out ASAP.
Well, yeah, in the patch, I'm imagining it's going to be probably thrown out there by the time most of our listeners hear this episode. I mean, really, when you get down to it, so it suddenly becomes a non-issue, right? I mean,
see, even Golden Panther says stabbers get on my nerves sometimes, but not as much as the javelin thing does. And, you know, I guess nobody's really devaluing that. They're not saying, you know, it's not an issue. It's certainly an issue. But again, I have to give a Sony standpoint and say it's not our issue. why do we need to fix your problem? If you have a stick up your ass because of it, then fix it. And I really think that's the best way to go. So, you know, out of the PC market and the Xbox market and the Sony market, I'm going to give it up to Sony on this one.
Oh, there you go. Then again, you do like Sony just a little bit better, right?
I'm not a shill for Sony.
Oh, okay. He's not a Sony shill. Yeah, Sony. Hey, shit, that is easy to say. In other Microsoft news, if you're into this whole thing, and I'm interested as in your position on this, Steve, being a musician and all, Slayer getting their game on. Kerry King and Dave Lombardo from the metal band Slayer will be on Xbox Live and can take on gold members in Halo 3 Slayer mode, of course. This is to promote their latest CD, World Pain Blood. You can join them on Wednesday, December 16th at 7 p.m. Eastern for the Carnage. So just fire up your Xbox and click on for more details, the gamertag info to send friend requests to, blah, 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 blah. The info I don't see here is whether or not, you know, the celebrity in question, in this case Slayer, will get on a headset and actually chat with fans while they play. I think it's kind of a cool thing and an alternative to Rock Band and Guitar Hero, where people are just getting not FaceTime, but, you know, game time, I guess, with someone that you're a fan of. I mean, do you think this is a cool idea?
I think it's an awesome idea, and because of not only the relevance of Xbox Live out there, but just the concept in and of itself. I mean, we know a lot of celebrities play on Xbox Live. Robin Williams says, I'm on all the time, but, you know, I'm not going to tell you what my gamer tag is. And every time you're playing and somebody new jumps in, you never know if, you know, you could be playing against Charlie Sheen or whoever is gaming on Xbox Live. Will Smith, too, a lot. But to come out and say, you know, hey, you know, we have a new album coming out and I'm going to talk about that. I'm sure they're going to be talking because I think it's a big part of the interactivity, because otherwise you don't even know if you're playing against these guys. And Kerry King has loose lips that sinks ships anyway. So I'm sure he's got a lot of smack to talk about the state of the music industry and everything. I think it's really cool. I think it's a great way for fans to get to interact. Slayer, certainly not as culturally relevant as they once were. So I think it's kind of a hip way for them to you know, kind of touch base with this generation. And I'm really surprised other artists haven't done this before. You got Weezer doing the Snuggie deal. It probably would have been a lot more conducive for them just to hop on Xbox Live and play like Uno or something.
Yeah, I mean, Uno's like the easiest, most casual game there is. And I remember when it came out, it's like it suddenly became my favorite game on Xbox, despite all the next generation great graphics and all that. It's like, you know what a great game to just sit there and shoot the shit with? Uno. So maybe this has been pitched to a lot of bands or celebs, and maybe they just turn their nose up at it going, you know what, I don't play games, but my niece does or my kids do, and it's not my thing. But it is a great thing for a band that their relevance aren't as great anymore. Slayer's getting old. They're not quite as old as like Kiss or whatnot, and wheeling out the wheelchairs and the walkers and the canes and everything, but not hitting the notes as high as they once could, because, yeah, you know, you grow old. What can you say? And this is not a new concept. I don't mean to, for the audience going, yes, Kyle, we know Xbox Live does this all the time. Yes, I know. I just thought it was an interesting subject to throw up because Slayer happens to be doing this at this particular time. In the past, it's been other bands like Dream Theater and other bands that'll get their own wallpapers and their themes and all that just to help connect to today's gamer generation. And yeah, it's another fantastic alternative. I don't know if Slayer has any downloadable content for a Guitar Hero or Rock Band or anything like that, but maybe they turned their nose up at that and thought, you know what, I'd rather play against the fans than just get our music out there. But who knows?
I like that. I like that departure from a music theme game. You know, I think it would almost seem too cliche if they did it that way. Playing a frag game. I mean, yeah. I mean, that's like so Slayer. I can like pop in some Slayer and throw my cans on and play a frag game, and you know, it's like a metalhead Nirvana. So I think it's a pretty great concept. And I think by the time we roll out our next podcast, I'm probably going to have a date and time for Perimeter Void meet and greet over at Uno on Xbox Live.
Ooh, that's badass. Now, speaking of Rock Band, you know, they are unleashing that network thing where people can just upload their own content and all that. You think you're going to get Perimeter involved in that?
I jumped on that from day one, and no official word's gone out yet when they're going to start the beta process. I'm really, really, really hoping we get accepted under the beta, because I mean, it's our first stuff. We'll have like the first stuff to get pushed out. So keeping my fingers crossed. It's kind of a weird situation with how they're rolling it out, where it's going to be charged content regardless. They're not going to do any of this for free. Essentially, they're behind all the coding for it. So they feel because the engineers have to work on your product to get it out there, there has to be a fee. They are being relatively reasonable, though, where there's actually three pricing brackets. I think the most expensive one's like just like $1.50, $1.75 or whatever, but they have a bracket down as low as 50 cents, and you share the revenue with the developer. I was kind of hoping for an option where I don't care, keep the money that you're making from everybody else. Let us push something out for free. I think that's really where the incentive is. If we can lay out some free tracks for Guitar Hero or Rock Band, whatever, I think people would be more willing to give it a shot. If you have a relatively unknown band, you get to actually drop coin to play their songs. I think that's where you kind of have a little struggle.
Yes. But Uno, man, that sounds like a great social, relaxed sort of thing. And there's no exploit codes in there. So, and Fanto in our chat room says, I like Uno on Xbox Live, especially the custom decks like the Street Fighter deck. See, I didn't even know they had that. I haven't played Uno on Xbox in a long time because I tend to play Uno now on my iPhone. But man, a Street Fighter deck? That's cool.
We still need to play some Left 4 Dead, so let's not forget that.
Oh, I know, right? ADD. Ooh, shiny. Shiny. That's right. We got to kill some zombies, man. Where to go? Where to go? Oh, yes. Let's go into the tech realm with the whole Facebook thing. They recently changed their privacy policy, and people are shouting from the rooftops going, hey, wait a minute. What the? And I had to deal with it on a very small level just because it said, you need to change this because my tweets weren't shipping over to Facebook. And now I fixed that. Of course, I had to unprotect my tweets on Twitter, which I didn't like because now anyone can follow me. But that's a whole Facebook thing. So let's talk about this whole change in the privacy policy.
Well, we were warned and now it's happened. As of Wednesday, social networking supermo Facebook unveiled sweeping changes to its privacy options for users. The new privacy controls, particularly the recommendation settings, have deployed the social network on the front line of the debate over data protection. Having told users that the change, quote, makes it easier for people to find them and learn about you, Facebook has effectively opened up a bottomless pit of personal data at their disposal to everyone on the web. The motivation for this is primarily to increase traffic to the site from search engines, inspired by growing competition from Twitter, and Twitter pages are fully indexed and searchable, thereby increasing ad revenue. As for now, when a new current user logs into Facebook, they'll be greeted by a pop-up asking them to review and update their privacy settings. While it is relatively easy for users to choose to keep their old settings, it's the new settings recommended by Facebook that have come under close scrutiny. If a user adopts Facebook's recommendations, then details of the user's gender, location, friends and family, as well as all posted content and status updates, could be found on search engines like Google or Bing. This represents a fundamental shift in Facebook's social media function. Instead of disseminating pictures and information amongst a closed social circle, it now broadcasts that information to the world. So rather than go on, it's some creepy stuff. And the reason why it's creepy is because I think a vast majority of web users, particularly when you talk about Facebook, let's face it, our moms are on Facebook. I don't know if they're going to catch this. I don't know if they're going to know how to change their privacy settings properly. Give this 2 weeks from today, guaranteed, and you're going to be laughing at some seriously hilarious shit on the front page of Dig, because people are going to start doing some Google searches and just find some incredible posts from ignorant people.
Well, you know, this happens in Mark, our illustrious engineer here, was telling me the other day about that. It's like, you know, major corporations will do little Google searches and try to keep up on social media to see what their employees or prospective employees are doing in their life. So if they said, yeah, I got totally shit faced the other night and, you know, I woke up in a puddle of blood and blah, blah, blah. It's like, do I want to hire that guy? And if their profile is available public, you know?
It's great because everybody's using it. Insurance adjusters are using it. There's a woman who was out of work collecting disability because she was quote unquote depressed. And they got pictures of her partying on a beach. And that was enough for her to get a termination letter for all her benefits. So, yeah, it's really no joke, particularly with employers now, particularly with the state of the economy now. They want the best of the best, the cream of the crop. So nobody's hesitating to Google you. And if Google's going to give your tweets as well as your Facebook status, I mean, that could be enough to just really, really, really damage any potential career.
Yeah. And here's where, like, you and Mark are like on my case about, it's like, dude, you know, quit Twittering everything about it. It's like, I'm taking a dump right now. It's like, well, yeah, that could cost me a gig. Wouldn't that be sad? It's like all based on a dump tweet. How sad is that?
Well, you never know. I mean, particularly with YouTube, one man's hilarity is another guy's, you know, death note. So it kind of does make you think twice. I mean, it's no secret that when it comes to things like Facebook and MySpace and that, I'm incredibly secluded. As very close personal friends, Because I've had problems in the past with associating with Kyle, little fanboys, little fangirls who want to get to Kyle through me. And I said, fuck, that's not going to happen anymore. So I'm just like, become really withdrawn. But sometimes you just come across really funny stuff and you're like, I want to share this. And then I think, you know, my supervisor is a Facebook friend. And if he takes offense to this, this could impact my job. And it's that stopping and thinking that saved my ass. And I think a lot of people, it's very gut reaction. How is this hilarious? I'm going to send this out there. That's bad enough as it stands now, but with the new privacy settings, and if you're not careful to go ahead and switch everything over to private, and this is coming back in public Google results, there's some very, very far-reaching ramification to this. And the sad part is, I understand why Facebook is doing it. To me, it's actually less of a sellout thing than what MySpace did. I think the reason people walked away from MySpace is that it just became so ad-laden, and you could tell, like, it just became very third-world country, the way they were going about trying to generate revenue. I understand where Facebook's going with it, because you got to stay afloat somehow, especially when you literally have tens of millions of people using Facebook. But, you know, maybe you can find a better way of paying the bills than potentially putting some very damaging and personal information out on the interwebs.
Yeah, and then it becomes a nice gray area when you retweet or share, you know, a funny link or a not safe for work YouTube video or something that you find funny. And it's like, and then what if you get in hot water over it and you go, you know what? I was just sharing with my friends. I didn't post it. I'm not responsible for that. What's, you know, where do you draw the line?
Right. I mean, and it probably opens up the floodgate for tons of lawsuits. You know, I'm at a con and I have a picture taken next to an attractive female and it ends up somebody's Facebook and somebody adds a smarmy comment. And next thing you know, I'm in divorce court. Can I sue? Is there libel or slander behind this? Can I go after people for posting this on their Facebook and then having it show up in public Google results?
Yeah, it's like, oh, you tagged me and that was the end of my marriage. What? Really?
And now I want 2.6 mil, you know, then I'll feel better.
That's right. Come on, Facebook, you got money. You're not fooling anyone. They don't need ad revenue. My God, they're banking. They're drowning in money.
Right now, but you know, as we keep talking about on this fine show, it's still the Wild West. There is no degree of normalcy out there. Everybody's scattering to do what they can while they can. You know, I don't know if we want internet reform or if we want it to keep going the way it is. It's kind of scary on either end. But again, I guess by having a pop-up window, if you're an existing Facebook user and it kind of alerts you, hey, you may want to change your settings. But I think the argument is that it's just very vague. I don't think people understand the way they spell it out. But on the other hand, if you had 10 pages of disclaimers and disclosures, people would go through that like a terms of service agreement and just click next, next, next. So I understand Facebook really can't win. I guess it makes it our job just to educate the uneducated and say, hey, you know, let me take a look at your Facebook. Let me make sure you're protected. So do yourself a favor and do your friends a favor. Do your family a favor. Do your moms a favor, because I think moms really need the favor on this. But help everybody out and have everybody secure their Facebook.
Yeah, when I saw the pop-up window, yeah, I took, you know, 5 minutes to read it. And it wasn't too clear to me what the new settings really entailed. But it did give you the option, you know, cut and dry. New settings, old settings. And by default, old settings was checkmarked. And for many of the things, I left it as such because I'm fine with that. I think I'm covered on all my bases there. But yeah, there's some people that just won't do it, just like there's people that won't go through a contract and read it from beginning to end because it's a lot of legalese and, you know, and it just becomes blurring from one word to the next. And you just want to like, no, I'll just whatever, I'll sign it. And then whatever, you're in trouble for whatever reason.
Yeah, I don't like trouble. That's why I don't post much on Facebook or Twitter.
You'd rather start trouble in real life, not online.
Right. It stays kind of isolated that way.
Yeah. All right. Let's move on to some music-related stuff, which is right up your alley, sir. Record labels facing $6 billion in damages for pirating artists.
Well, actually, if you don't mind, and I'll give Mark some work to edit this in post, I want to talk about this other one first, about a judge finalizing a $675,000 RIAA policy verdict, but they won't gag the defendant. Federal judge Monday finalized a $675,000 jury verdict against the defendant, who went to trial after the Recording Industry Association of America sued him for file sharing. U.S. District Judge Nancy Gertner presided over the Joel Tenenbaum case in summer 2009. Tenenbaum was only the nation's second individual defendant not to settle with the RIAA before trial. The judge also issued an injunction preventing the 25-year-old Boston University student from file sharing. Though Gertner said an injunction barring Tenenbaum from undertaking any more illegal file sharing was appropriate, she declined the RIAA's request to censor Tenenbaum's speech after the jury verdict in which he was found liable for infringing 30 songs. Tenenbaum promoted piracy and railed against the verdict, and the RIAA wanted the judge to quiet him. Although plaintiffs are entitled to statutory damages, they have no right to silence defendant's criticism of the statutory regime under which he is obliged to pay those damages, Gertner wrote. The court has neither the desire nor the authority to serve as the censor of defendant's public remarks regarding one's file sharing. Gertner also expanded on the pretrial ruling, which she declared Tenenbaum could not render a so-called fair use defense. Tenenbaum claims that his file sharing was not counter to the Copyright Act. The act provides up to $150,000 in damages for each infringed song, and the figures are left to jurors. The only other accused file share to go to trial against the RIAA was Jamie Thomas Rassett. The RIAA won a whopping $1.92 million verdict against a Minnesota woman this summer for sharing 24 songs on Kazaa. In the last 6 years, the RIAA sued about 30,000 individuals for file sharing. Most defendants have settled out of court. The RIAA is winding down its litigation campaign against individuals and is instead working with internet service providers to come up with plans that might lead to cutting off internet access for repair, digital copyright, blah, 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 blah. Part of his argument was fair use. Fair use isn't going to fly. You download somebody's copyrighted music, fair use is not going to fly in a court of law. But one of the arguments that his lawyers put forward is that it's unconstitutional to seek those types of damages because, I guess, written in the law, in the violation of Copyright Act, you can pay damages as little as $750 per infraction. So he's asking the court to reduce the verdict to $22,500, which is the minimal allowable. I think that's fair. I think that's fine. You know, $22,500, that's still a lot of money. That's going to hurt your pocketbook. You learned your lesson, you know, pay for your crime and move on. When you start talking $1.9 million and $675,000 against a 25-year-old college student, I mean, it's unrealistic at that point. You're really going to cripple this dude financially for the rest of his life because he downloaded a few songs. I don't think the artists have this in mind. I mean, certainly the labels are trying to, you know, quote-unquote, recoup on damages, but that's ridiculous because how many times over would you have to buy these albums to equate to that figure? I would, you know, shit. If you pirated my stuff, pay for the price of the album, and I'm happy. I still get compensated for it. I don't care. These damages are just ridiculous, and it's rather refreshing to know that they're winding down on these, what I consider, frivolous lawsuits.
Well, it's all frivolous, because everyone who's being sued aren't millionaires, so I don't think any examples being made. Is everyone afraid to stop downloading a song? No, I think people still do it without looking back. The people who are sued are they people that just downloaded, or are they people that file shared? Like, did they put the material up there, or did they simply download an album?
In both cases, with the woman that got whacked with the $1.9 million judgment and this gentleman here, both cases have been because they're file sharers. Now, what happens if you use a software program like Kazaa to download your music? It automatically installs a share folder on your computer. Anything you download by default ends up in your shared folder, which means other people can get it from you. Like the torrent system, you're a seeder, and they're leeching off your seeds. So because you're making it available, that's where infringement comes into play. To my knowledge, nobody yet has been successfully sued for just downloading music. If you go into a torrent site and you download an album, you're keeping it on your drive. You're not making it available for anybody else for seeds or anything. You're not making physical copies and handing them out. You can't get sued. Will that time come? Yeah, probably, because once, you know, this option is dead now. Going after people for sharing, it's already dead. RIAA says we're pulling out of this because it's really giving us a bad rap. Yeah, I think they're going to turn to the people that are downloading. I think that becomes a lot more convoluted, though. They've had a hard time going after people for IP reasons, saying people are leeching off my Wi-Fi. There's a lot of excuses out there to, you know, have some defense to making music available. When it comes just to downloading, it becomes a lot more convoluted. It's a lot more involved, a lot more difficult to prove. So I don't know. I don't know if we're really going to see this, but it would make sense for me anyway if they went that route. I just think, again, it would just be a lot more bad publicity for this organization. The model has to change, not the customer.
I don't see them getting their face back because they've lost it many years ago already. How are they going to get any respect back? I don't know. It's probably too little too late, really. I mean, all the, you know, when you sue someone in court and it actually sticks, when you ruin and devastate someone financially like that, man, I think the fans know. I think even people who don't download, they know about this stuff because they check their emails, they read online blogs, they know about it. The messages are going out there. There's no positive press for this. And again, like you said, I don't think the musicians had this in mind either.
Well, you know, it's really unfortunate because I've talked about before with iTunes where, because of legal reasons, artists can't come out and say exactly how much they compensated per 99 cent download. Weird Al Yankovic wrote a very, very nasty letter over to Apple along with his label, and he kind of let it slip that it was somewhere around 4 cents per sale that went to the artist. So I'm not sure how much Apple's cut is, but the record label, goes without saying, is making a tremendous cut in comparison to what the artists are getting compensated. Now, here's where the hypocrisy lies. I'm going to jump right into our next article here. The record labels are now facing $6 billion in damages for pirating artists. How do you like this for fair play? It's no secret that major record labels have a double standard when it comes to copyright. On the one hand, they try to put operators of BitTorrent sites in jail and ruin the lives of single mothers and students demanding hundreds of thousands of dollars in fines. And on the other, they sell CDs containing music for which they haven't obtained copyright permission. In the past, we've covered many disputes between artists and labels, where the latter is being accused of or even sued for using songs without permission. Just a few months ago, Latin America's biggest artist, Alejandro Fernandez, sent the police to a Sony Music office to confiscate over 6,000 CDs that the label refused to return. And this is just the tip of the iceberg. The labels have made a habit of using songs from a wide variety of artists for compilation CDs without securing the rights. They simply use the recording and make note of it on the, quote, pending list so they can deal with it later. This has been going on since the 1980s, and since then, the list of unpaid tracks or copyright infringements has grown to 300,000. Growing tired of label piracy, a group of artists have filed a class action lawsuit in Canada against four major record labels to the CRIA, the local equivalent of the RIAA. In October last year, Warner Music, Sony BMG Music, EMI Music, and Universal Music were all sued for illegal use of thousands of tracks, and at the present, the case is still underway. How and why this blatant copyright infringement could go on for years is a mystery, but the label's double standard has been picked up by the plaintiffs as well. The conduct of the defendant record companies is aggravated by their strict strict and unremitting approach to the enforcement of the copyright interest against consumers, the artists argue in their claim for damages. The suit is still ongoing, but already the labels have admitted to owing at least $50 million in infringing the rights of artists, and this figure could grow as high as $6 billion. So, who's the real pirates here?
Hypocrisy, not a big shock, honestly. And, you know, it makes me wonder. It's like, okay, if you're a starving musician and artist, is it really the greatest thing in the world to get a record contract in this environment, in this day and age anymore? Or are you really better off doing it all grassroots style, like Perimeter of the Void, for example?
Well, I understand the allure of the record labels. And, you know, we talked about an article posted a while back by Trent Reznor, who talked about the state of the recording industry and said the people who need the labels are the American Idol people, the pop stars, because the one thing that a label can provide that a grassroots startup can't is tons of operating revenue up front. A record label can get you commercials and billboards and public appearances and just really have that hype machine behind you. When you're independent, like Perimeter of the Void, you don't have that startup revenue. We can't get billboards and skywriting and publicity stunts like that. So a label is certainly beneficial. The drawback to working with a record label is this is all in advance with interest. When you sign a major record label deal, all the promotion up front is, you know, essentially written as a bill to you. Your recording of your album is a bill written to you. Your elaborate stage show with your 30 dancers in the background and your lights and your smoke and your lift that brings you up from the bottom of the stage is all a bill written to you. And the artists don't make any money back until their album becomes profitable. And in a lot of cases, this doesn't happen for bands. There are bands, major label bands that you see on TV all the time who are making minimum wage. By the way, this breaks down. The people that you see on Cribs and everything, they're very few and far between to your average artist who are putting out mainstream music, and they're barely getting by. And that's really sad. What's the alternative? You do it yourself. Without that hype machine behind it, without the ability to go ahead and get arenas and tour buses and security and merchandise, it does make it an uphill battle.
And then you use this little thing called social media that some people are afraid of, and justifiably so in some respects, but it all comes to you know, wielding it responsibly. But the power of social media, that's got the attention too, not just piracy, but to see that a Twitter and a Facebook and sites like that can have the power. I mean, you can never deny that the power of the word of mouth. It trumps billboards. It trumps all the glitz and glam and all the commercials and all the multi-million dollar ad buys and everything. Honestly, it just comes down to that. That's always been a truism.
I guess you see that to a certain degree. I think people also appreciate traditional advertising. You know, traditional advertising isn't dead. And there are people that still pay tens of millions of dollars a year to hire these big advertising firms to come up with a way of getting your image out there. And I think those people are always going to have that advantage for that reason, because you can be involved with the new iteration of Rock Band and Guitar Hero coming out. They want to slap your face on there, and they want to slap your music on there because for them it's a selling point. Again, for the indie artists, you don't necessarily have those ends. I can't call up Quentin Tarantino and ask him to direct a video for Perimeter of the Void, but if I was under a major record label and they were willing to throw that much money behind backing that project, they could do that. So yeah, I'm not underestimating the ability to tweet or Facebook or whatever. I'm just saying, having a label can provide you a lot more bang for your buck, but you're really going to have to make that buck stretch compared to doing it on your own.
Yeah. If you got $1 million contract from a record label, and that sounds all great, but yeah, it's essentially a bill. They're charging you up front for it. And until they make that back, you're not going to get anything out of it. So it's like when you told me the story about your friend who's in, you know, Prong, or was in that metal band Prong, and would tour, but he had to have a day job. Yeah, he got to go different places and play and do what he loves, but he wasn't really making ends meet.
When I bought my motorcycle, there was a Craigslist ad. Some guy was getting rid of some helmets, and I went over to his house, and he lived really close to a guy who has an incredible home studio that my previous band used to record at. And we're talking music and talking about the producer who lived down the street. And he's like, well, you know, my son was in this band, Willem Scream. And I'm like, oh, yeah, I remember them. Quite a lot of success toward Europe, toward Japan. And he said, without missing a beat, and didn't make a buck doing it. They get to see the world, and they had a blast doing it, but they came back to nothing. You know, every single cent of their expenses was just absorbed by going on tour. And I don't know. For me, I need something a little more tangible. I'm also in a different predicament. I'm married, I get a kid, I get another one on the way. I need finances. My concern isn't getting out and partying. So I don't know. Nowadays, it's kind of weird. You kind of have to weigh why you're even getting into the business to begin with. Me personally, I'm in it to make a buck, as I think most artists are.
It's not to get laid. Yeah, you already got a wife, but most other musicians get to get laid.
That's true. But at some point, you got to pay the bills. You know, at some point, I guess you grow up and you want a little retirement egg.
Ah, yes, retirement eggs. What are those? Social Security. What's that? I don't know. It's an alien concept. Well, we have one more topic here. Let's delve back into something a little happier than paying the bills. Talk about cult TV shows. And this actually speaks a little bit more to our older listeners in the audience, and most of them are not older, so they're probably tuning out on all this. But one of our favorite websites, Steve, me, and now Mark as well, our illustrious engineer, we like toplessrobot.com. They have a great sense of humor, style, and everything about this. And one of their newest articles, as we're doing our show here, the 12 nerdiest cult shows that still need to be on DVD and still aren't. In this day and age, you can get tons of obscure shows on DVD that were either highly rated or poorly rated, that were just terrible. But some, you scratch your head and go, how come this isn't available? And again, this kind of speaks to the old one. And I know, Steve, you're a big fan of this show. I never really got into it personally. But starting with number 12, Max Headroom. Okay, I really, really don't know. I know there was pretty much a British TV show, and they took the character of Max Headroom, which I think they used for either Coke or Pepsi or something back in mid-80s as an advertising icon, and he was huge. And then they came with this 1984-esque, dark, dystopian TV show that didn't last very long but did garner a pretty big cult-sized audience.
It did. I can't say I was a tremendous fan, but I was very aware of the pop relevance at the time.
Yeah, yeah. And I don't know. All I remember about Max Headroom is just the way he looked. He had a couple music videos. And the plot, to me, when I saw like the pilot episode, I couldn't keep up with it. So I, you know, whatever. If it comes on DVD, someone will buy it, not me.
I'm more curious about number 11 because not only is it a show I'm not familiar with, but I don't even know how to pronounce it.
Serafinowicz.
Tell us more, Kyle.
Oh, okay then. Peter Serafinowicz. Yeah, he's a Brit dude too, actually. And he is best known as the voice of Darth Maul. But you can actually see him because he's an on-camera actor in a lot of BBC favorites such as Spaced and Look Around You and Couples. And, of course, there's Shaun of the Dead. He's like Shaun's good friend who becomes a zombie. He's got a very low voice. And then once you know that he's Darth Maul, you go, oh, yeah, I could see that. So I haven't seen that show either because I don't really follow British television. But that's another cult one that's apparently not available and apparently should be.
I know a big one that you and I were both very aware of at the time, and we're still going to salivate over it now, is Liquid Television. You know, it was MTV's animated anthology series that gave us Beavis and Butthead and Aeon Flux. We were talking about this before the show started. The really big issue that's facing this release on DVD is that it's compiled from so many different animators and so many different studios, and all while they were up and coming, and now that they're pretty entrenched in the scene, it's nearly impossible to gather up the rights and just kind of come to some amicable deal for this thing to hit street.
Yeah. I mean, we were talking before we started the show about the Max. I think that was that had the moniker of Liquid Television on it. And it was basically, God, this was over a decade ago. And it was what is today known as a motion comic pretty much to me, because it first came out as a comic book. And then it was animated and it was dark and cool and different. But and I thoroughly enjoyed it. And I wish it would come out. You can only find it, you know, if you go to like a comic book convention and you get on a bootleg DVD or something like that. But apparently, I guess Amazon is going to make it available on some on demand type disc thing. But I don't know. Hopefully MTV will figure that out, because I know they've more than made a fair share in return profit on Aeon Flux in various incarnations.
Right, and I wonder if that's what we'll eventually see, is as the individual rights holders want to capitalize on it, they'll go ahead and they'll give Viacom the rights to make a DVD release, and I encourage that.
Yeah. Number 9, again, this goes over a lot of people's heads, but the Uncle Floyd show, which was like the demented children's show turned cult phenomenon, like a no budget thing, based in New Jersey. Floyd Vivino started his show in 1974, and this actually became a launch pad for a lot of new wave and post-punk bands like Squeeze, the Ramones, Lords of the New Church, the Bongos, Cyndi Lauper. They all made their U.S. TV debut on this show, and people just don't know all about it. And he had like people from Monty Python, Howard Stern were a guest on his show back in the end of the day. But it's just one of those that just kind of slipped under the radar, apparently.
And number eight, another one that apparently slipped under the radar, especially my radar, is Journeyman. And all I can really tell you about that, it was another NBC series that was hyped and then dropped when it underperformed in the ratings. Other than that, I have to admit, I'm pretty clueless about the show.
I think it was a time travel thing. I could be wrong. But another case of, like Fox, letting a show that maybe is a little bit headier, maybe a sci-fi concept, instead of giving it time to really find its audience, give it a few, and then they just get gun shy and just yank it off the airwaves. A lot of times these shows, these new concepts will come out and they'll get yanked and they'll come out on DVD and then they'll recoup their cost. I don't know why NBC wouldn't jump on the bandwagon of being quick to do that with this show, with any other show that, that failed to ignite as far as ratings was concerned.
It's a weird marketing thing. Everybody feels now that you release something, and after the second episode, it has to be an absolute rating smash, or we need to yank the plug because we're just sinking too much funds into it. It's a really weird phenomenon, especially when shows like X-Files were allowed, in my opinion, to go on far, far past their prime. They should have snipped them at the end of season six and had an ass ton of money to put in other properties, but I guess we have to pay for the misstep somehow.
All right. How about number seven on our list of 12 nerdy cult shows that should be on DVD? I don't even remember this one.
I don't either. And ironically enough, it came out, you know, during the Star Wars era. Maybe we were too caught up in the sci-fi scene at the time. But Bigfoot and Wild Boy, I don't know. You know, I gotta say, just from the title alone, and even all these decades later, I'm kind of curious. I kind of wish this would come out on DVD now so I can see what all this buzz is about.
Well, yeah, it's from Sid and Marty Krofft, who brought you a lot of your childhood favorites, including one of my favorites growing up, Land of the Lost. And this one definitely slipped past my mind. You know, come 1977, all I can think of at the time, again, of course, was Star Wars. And this one apparently focused on a friendly Bigfoot raising a feral child who possesses perfect diction, and together they encounter aliens and supernatural beings. I don't know. It's either really, really bad or something. I'm surprised maybe even sci-fi not getting a hold of this and airing it for the hell of it.
I mean, seriously, it could probably become this big cult thing. We can get the Mystery Science 3000 treatment or whatever, but yeah, I mean, there's a little YouTube video of the intro that Kyle and I are staring at right now. And I think after having watched that, I'm kind of sucked in.
Yeah, you guys need to drop us an email if you've heard of these shows and if you have any memory of it whatsoever. mail@thebigballbroadcast.com. How about number six on our list? Little Muppet Monsters. I know about The Muppet Show. I know about Muppet Babies. But this was apparently a companion show to Muppet Babies and aired in CBS briefly in 1985, before Jim Henson pulled the plug. He said, you know what, this is not happening. I'm not really liking it. So a lot of Muppet hardcore fans are like, put it out. We want to collect everything Muppets. I don't know if it's anywhere as nearly as inspired as the latest viral video from the Muppets, the Bohemian Rhapsody sung by the Muppets. Did you see that?
That was incredible. That was so badass. I didn't even know that there was a current incarnation of Muppet Studios and that they were doing stuff. And if you go over and find their page on YouTube, they have like four or five projects, all in HD, all brand new stuff utilizing the Muppets. I think it's a great way to reintroduce them to pop culture. I kind of learned the mistake though. 2 years old, I think, is a little too young to watch the Muppets because they are a little creepy, and Jonathan really didn't want to be part of them after that. It's not Sesame Street.
No, not so much. Yeah.
But I will say this. What was really great about Little Muppet Monsters is, you know, it was animated And rather than taking the baby mode from the Muppet Babies, it was the Muppets we knew them as their live television incarnation. They were all done as adults, and it was actually done quite well. And also, this is all done by Jim Henson was still alive. So Jim Henson himself was producing this, and you can really tell it lends that credibility of Henson because the guy was just absolutely brilliant. And it's unfortunate that it was so short-lived, but with a little resurgence of the Muppets now, I wouldn't be surprised if this, you know, came out on DVD in the next year or two.
Yeah. Now, number five on our list of nerdy cult shows that still need to be on DVD, according to toplessrobot.com. I know you remember this. I remember this. The Amazing Spider-Man. This was long before, obviously, Sam Raimi made millions of dollars for Sony with the big screen version. This was super, super, super cheesy with Nicholas Hammond, who was before that best known as one of the kids on The Sound of Music. And then he played this hammy performance as Peter Parker / Spider-Man. And it even had a porn-tastic theme song. Yay. And apparently it was available on VHS for one point, but it's just darn aggravating that you can't get this cheesy show from hell on DVD yet, because I would probably buy this in a heartbeat if I saw it on DVD.
I think I'd pass. I bought the Spider-Man 63 animated collection, and I'm happy with that amount of cheese. The live-action show, it was just really the epitome of cheese. So I think I enjoyed it when I was a little kid. I couldn't go through it again as an adult.
Yeah, and the same is probably true for, like, the next one, which was a big hit. Huge, huge rating success. And I don't know. I don't know why it's not available. We're talking about the $6 million man, Steve Majors. We can make him bigger, stronger, faster. All of this cheesy, cheesy stuff. A bionic man. Oy. Apparently, if you're European, though, you can get it on DVD. And same for the bionic woman, which I had a huge crush on, Lindsay Wagner, back in the day. She even came to my elementary school one time, and I got like a signed trading card.
And a stiffy.
And a stiffy. Yes, that's right. Why do I feel so strange down between my legs? But yeah. So yeah, that's another show that I don't think would stand the test of time other than to laugh at a lot.
But at the time, it was great. I mean, growing up and watching this, you're like, oh my God, I want bionic implants. That just seems like the most badass thing ever. I wanted the action figures. I wanted the playsets. It was kind of the precursor to the big G.I. Joe explosion. I think this is like every little boy's like first action figure, and I'm going to go in and kick ass.
Right.
Another show I have to admittedly say I have no history with whatsoever is Manic Mansion.
Nor I. I'm completely in the dark about what that is.
Oh, boy. I guess apparently it's the little blurb here. It was a sitcom loosely based on Lucasfilm's classic point-and-click computer game, and it aired on the basic cable halfway house known as the Family Channel during the early 1990s.
Oh, jeez.
And even after that to use, I have no interest.
Wow. Number two, I remember watching a lot as a little kid, was In Search Of, because you saw Leonard Nimoy, Mr. Spock, not as Mr. Spock. You know, he would do all this In Search Of, and they would basically talk about X-Files type conspiracy theories. They would talk about the Loch Ness Monster, UFOs, the Bermuda Triangle. Super cheesy, of course, because it was done in the 70s when everyone had big hair and awful fashion sense and everything. But I would get a kick out of watching these old Leonard Nimoy In Search Of shows again.
It was great. You know, I harken back to his search, and it was like, and lo, Otherworld Steve was born. You know, holy shit, this is what just got me thinking on those different angles, those different, you know, conspiratorial type ways, you know, talking about shit like Atlantis and D.B. Cooper and, like you said, Kyle, all the X-Files type stuff. For me as a kid, this was just, it was stimulating. It's something I became obsessive over. It's like, wow, all this shit that we don't know, and different people are telling all their different bullshit takes on it, and you still don't know what the reality is in the end. It was great. And one reason I'd love to see this come out on DVD now is just to reminisce on the explanations that they had for the phenomenon at the time, and how much of it science has explained away by now. Quite a bit of time has passed, so that'd be a pretty interesting retrospect.
The good old days, just like watching a Carl Sagan, you know, Cosmos episode or everything. And of course, we got to end our top 10 list with number one, drum roll, please. Batman, the original 1960s TV series starring the classic Adam West Batman. Too many hardcore fans is still the definitive Batman, not Christian Bale, not Michael Keaton, not George Clooney, and not Val Kilmer. But, you know, even if this is in reruns, I can't watch it more than like 30 seconds because it's so awful. But growing up, man, it was the shit.
Oh, my God. I can still watch it. I don't want to sound hypocritical because I said Spider-Man was just too cheesy to watch again now. But Batman, it's really hard to know when you're watching it what the intent was. Was it done to be that cheesy? Or, you know, some people take it a little serious and it made it more cheesy. You had some brilliant, brilliant actors involved in the show. You had Burgess Meredith. You had, what's his name? Cesar
Romero. Yeah.
Cesar Romero as the Joker. I mean, you had a very formidable cast. And, of course, now you have, Adam West, just so ingrained in pop culture, the mayor and Family Guy, and he's still out there doing a lot of voice acting shtick, and he goes to the cons and did a retrospect recently on what it was like to be part of the Batman original series and what production was like. It's something that it lived on is seemingly forever on television. It was in syndication for the longest time. And even if you didn't get to see the first run back in the 60s, you sure saw it in the 70s and the 80s. So it's like the Brady Bunch. It's something we all grew up in. It's everybody's guilty little pleasure. And, you know, you flip through the channels 2-3 o'clock in the morning and it's on. I think more often than not, you kind of like to kick back for 22 minutes and reminisce. And I don't think there's really any shame in that. So embrace your Batman geekness, Kyle.
Oh, yeah, I have to. I really do. But for those who are interested in that show, will it ever come out? Will it see the light of day? We talked about months ago that maybe a precursor that a fanboy's wish list would hope that Fox and Warner Brothers could get along long enough to make some sort of agreement, because Fox owns the right to the TV series and Warner Brothers owns the right to the Batman characters. That is the technical legal holdup why you don't see season box sets of Batman, the TV series. And I don't see that coming to light any soon, you know, maybe because the Watchmen legal case even happened.
Yeah, and I don't think it would really be a cash cow. It'd be more of a cult thing. Maybe it's for the best. Maybe sometimes it's better just to remember it for what it is and not necessarily feel the need to relive it.
Yeah, because you know Fox and Warner Brothers would have dollar signs in their eyes to try to somehow tie it into, you know, Dark Knight or, you know, the eventual third Batman movie with Chris Nolan that everyone's just clamoring at the bit for. But as it is, we're probably not going to see shit. Oh, well.
And as it is, I don't think you're going to hear any more shit from this podcast because that was our last story and we're about out of time.
Gosh, look at the time. We got to get out of here. We have like one more show for 2009. So you guys have any ideas, any suggestions, feedback, whatever, MP3 comments, please shoot them our way. mail@thebigballbroadcast.com. Any last minute plugs there, Steve?
PerimeterTheVoid.com. Everything that I could possibly say to you is there in print.
That's right. KyleAbear.com for voice acting consultations. Remember, buy one, get one free through the end of this year. $75 over Skype to critique your voice acting skills. And thanks to Mark for pushing buttons, sitting behind the scenes. Keep the server alive on StickCam.com. Thanks to everyone in our chat room. Britt, Golden Panther, Jenna, Kamina, Miss November, Nate the Great One, Neo Manga, Queen Lol, Russ, Speedy D, Yanjuni, and Zell, and our lurkers, of course, who are too afraid to log in.
Hope that changes in the future. Anyway, that's all the time we have, kids. So till next time, this is Kyle Hebert.
And this is Underworld Steve.
See ya!